the Q ratio, average convergence, divergence, basis points, and BS. Financial shows love to sound smart, but on Money Matters, we want to make you smart. That's why the goal is to keep you informed and empowered. Our focus, providing clear, actionable information without the financial jargon to help 1 million families retire sooner and happier. Based on the long-running WSB radio show, this Money Matters podcast is tailor-made for both modern retirees and those still in the planning stages. Join us in this exciting new chapter, and let's journey toward a financially secure and joyful retirement together. Welcome to Money Matters. I'm your host, Wes Moss, along with Connor Miller, Chief Investment Officer, Capital. And thanks for being here, of course, as always.
Thanks for having me on, and happy March. I can't believe feels like we made it.
We finally made it. We finally made it. And there's a lot of big time headlines that have happened. The markets finally started to hit some all time highs. We've gotten several of them in these first 2 months of the year. Some of the biggest mergers that we've seen, huge earnings from Nvidia, biggest credit card deal we've seen since, it's been almost 15 years with Discover and Capital One. Of course, that's now maybe getting challenged or blocked, which we've seen a lot of mergers. And then, of course, we haven't talked about the Buffett letter that's recently come out. And every time we get a Buffett letter, it always provides such great insight and it's so helpful as investors. And one of the questions I got this week, Connor, had to do with an investor just being – this is a listener emailing and saying, gosh, Warren Buffett seems always, first of all, I think this happens a lot. It feels like Warren Buffett's always saying there's not a whole lot out there to buy. And that there's always this headline of how much cash Berkshire has. And the numbers are always really staggering. Now, it's gotten to be such a giant company, but there's usually not a whole lot of context about this. And this is an article that says, as of the end of last year, Berkshire has and they always say Buffett, but it's really Berkshire has an excess of $167 billion in cash and cash equivalents. And then you start thinking, wait a minute, he's holding a lot of cash. Then you get another headline that says that the reason there's so much cash is owing to a lack of viable investment opportunities, which leads people to say, what's Warren Buffett saying? Does it mean the market's overvalued? He's holding that much cash? Has Buffett gone to cash? Is he out of the market because there's nothing good to invest in? And I think it's a really good topic here today, Connor Miller. First of all, we did some math around this.
Yeah.
Is that what Buffett is saying or no?
Well, I think, one, you have to consider the size of Berkshire today, and it's just to make a move that's going to be substantial to their share price. I mean, there's just not that many companies out there left for him to acquire that are really going to move the needle as well.
Right. So this is interesting. If you think about, first of all, if you look at the market capitalization, so the total size of Berkshire, and I'm rounding here, is call it 850 to 900 billion. So we're approaching a $1 trillion valuation. And then you start to think about, well, how much then is 167 million or billion in cash? Seems like it's an extraordinarily large number, but just divide it by its size and it's 18% in cash, which means 82% of Berkshire Hathaway is invested, which for an investor to be over 80% in stock, that's close to being fully invested. So it's not as, I think the headline points to there's so much cash, there's no opportunities. To your point, Connor, he said that it's going to take a lot to move the meter. You could easily read that as he's not seeing anything that he wants to own, but it doesn't mean that he's out of the market. The other thing that I think is really interesting is that unlike the $500 million to $1 trillion plus companies, it's hard to find one that isn't making some sort of product or selling some sort of service. We got Nvidia earnings a couple of weeks ago. They're making semiconductors. We know that Apple, of course, makes iPhones and sells subscriptions to 10 different services that you pay $9 a month for, and they have the revenue coming in. And it's about what are they doing next? And Ford and GM and Tesla, they're selling cars. And you look through the Dow Jones or in the S&P 500, the oil companies are pulling oil out of the ground and they're selling oil. Berkshire's not doing any of that. They're not making anything. They're really like almost like a mutual fund.
Yeah, they're really a conglomerate of sorts because the core business of Berkshire really is a small piece of the overall profitability when you think about all the other companies that they own.
Well, I guess in fairness, some of the wholly owned companies are making candy, they're making furniture, but that's not going to move the meter, right? A new line of living room sofas is not going to move the meter for Berkshire.
Not of that size.
So really, they're in the business of finding a company that can then move the meter, which is very different than most companies that we think about. When we think about buying pieces of businesses or becoming equity holders, we're thinking, what's the company going to do next? What's the next big thing for this company? What's the next service, product, offering they're going to have that will be big enough to move their earnings? As an example, we got a headline this week that Apple decided to stop making or the project that was supposedly, and it was very clandestine, but making a car. So they exited the car business, and there's a lot of reasons for that. Maybe making a car with low margins, and we know that electric vehicles are pretty difficult to make money from still at this stage in their life cycle and in the history of electric vehicles in the auto industry. They're saying it's going to be really hard to move the meter to our earnings when we enter into this really expensive low margin business. So maybe is that why they exited the business?
Yeah. I mean, it's a project that they've been working on, I think, for 10 years now. Originally, it was going to come out a couple years ago, kept getting pushed back. And I think you're right. Ultimately, they just decided it wasn't going to be profitable enough relative to the other products that they could be investing in to really move the needle.
I should have started today's episode out with this. Is Warren Buffett saying the stock market is overvalued? Straight ahead here on Money Matters. That's really what I should have said. So if you're just tuning in, that's the sentiment we're talking about here. The investment world follows Buffett very closely. He has become well known as the greatest of all time, kind of the GOAT investment guru of our age. But he's also been doing it for a very long time. We're reviewing some of the principles in Morgan Housel's book last Sunday here on Money Matters. One of them, I think my favorite is no one is crazy when it comes to how they think about their money. Producer Mallory, her favorite, by the way, is Tails You Win. Maybe we'll revisit that. But there's a whole chapter that Housel talks about, and this is, again, how we think about our money is very helpful to how we behave and how we execute and think about money. And one of the lessons is to understand that in any sort of outcome, there's a lot of course, there's risk, but there's also a lot of luck. But nobody ever talks that when things go well, you typically don't hear it talked about in terms of luck. And what Housel was saying is that, yes, Buffett's taken a lot of risk, but part of what he has done is just he has been lucky. You could call it luck or not, but he's just been in the game for so long. And he started in the 1960s, which was a pretty good time to get started in the market. And he's just survived in the game almost longer. I'm sure there's other people that are out there that maybe have a slightly longer horizon of investing, but I don't know of one. You've got to, and every new annual shareholder letter publishes the results from when they started, and his start back in 1965. All the way through last year, we're talking about almost 60 years worth of investing. Talk about compounding. And the results really are, they're starkly different than the overall market. Now, Morgan Housel will say part of that is just being in the game forever. And there are other investors that have had higher compound rates of return. There's a story he tells about a hedge fund guy who averaged over 60% rates of return, annualized rates of return, 60%. But came nowhere close to having the net worth of Buffett because he was not in the game for very long relative to, and almost very few people are in the game as long as Warren Buffett, approaching, call it, three quarters of a century.
And even a guy like Warren Buffett may say that if he was to start today, he may not have the same success over the next what is that, 60 years as he had over the last 60 years. It may be a little bit harder to start something like that.
And another thing that they intimate in the latest shareholder letter is that it's going to be hard to repeat the kind of rates of return relative to the market than they've seen in the past because they are so big and they're not making something brand new. They're just finding another company to add to the portfolio. And that's really what could move the meter for them because they're really an investment company.
And I think about just the, you know, the speed at which information moves today, 40, 50, 60 years ago, that value of being able to source all that information may be more reflected in
his earlier numbers.
Yeah.
And if you go back, there are some really, the big years that he had were arguably his earlier years. I mean, you can go back and see there was a 100% return year for Berkshire. You've got to go back to 1979 when Berkshire was up 102%. In that given year, the stock market or the S&P 500 was up 18% that year. So there were some massive years early on. 19 looks like 85. This is a long table here. 1985 up, call it 93%. The stock market was up 31.6%. So there in those early years, you had some giant upswings, and we haven't seen that now for the last call it 10, 20. 25 years or 30 years, but the results have been really consistent. So here are the numbers. And this just goes back to another thing Morgan Housel was talking about is that within the power of compounding, a small shift, if you give it a ton of time, can really add up enormously. So 1 or 2 or 3% may not sound like a lot in any given year. And it may not even be that big of a deal over 5 years or 10 years, but over 30 and 40 and 50 years, that compounding can be enormous. So Berkshire's compounded at 19.8% per year, almost 20% per year. S&P 500 has compounded an average of 10.2. So you would think just on the surface, it's about double, but the long-term results are nowhere near double. S&P 500 is up 31,000%. We'll put it in number context, in investment context. 10,000, if you'd been invested that entire time, would be worth about 3.1 million. Now you double the rate of return. Do we just double the total compounded rate of return? Not even close. So for Buffett, it's 4.38, if I can even read this, the print's so small, 4.38 million percent. So $10,000 would have turned into 438 million versus a measly 3.1. Pretty amazing numbers. The power of compounding, it can build continents, countries. Here's something from that latest letter from Buffett. I can't remember a period since March 11th, 1942, the date of my first stock purchase, that I've not had a majority of my net worth in equities, U.S.-based equities. And he says, and so far, so good. Dow Jones Industrial Average fell below 100 on that fateful day in 1942 when I pulled the trigger. And I was down about $5 by the time school was out. This is why everybody loves this guy. Can you think of this young guy who bought stock and after math or after English, I'm down $5. Soon things turned around and now that index hovers around 38,000, which there it is. Here we are today. America has been a terrific country for investors. All they've needed to do is sit quietly listening to no one. All they have needed to do is sit quietly and listen to no one. I guess that's for investors, sit quietly and listen to not the salacious headlines about the world falling apart.
Not us though, right? They can still listen to us.
They can still listen to us. And there was a nuclear headline this week. NATO troops come into, if they come into Ukraine, Putin says this means this could start a nuclear conflict. It's not the first time he said that. He's brought up the word nuclear several times in the past. And by the way, everyone quickly said, no, we're not sending troops. So there's always this worry that, yeah, something really bad could happen. And that's just, that's the reality of the world. And we've got, we have to be able to be long-term optimistic and understand that in the short run, yeah, it's totally natural to be scared and nervous about what could be happening today, tomorrow, this week, next month. But the reality is that we have to live through those really significant, scary moments. And they happen constantly. We're constantly surprised. More money matters straight ahead. How does setting the goal to have income for a lifetime sound? It's not a trick question. Many happy retirees create income for a lifetime, and it's something that's called income investing. It's a way to harness the power of many different forms of cash flow, including rent, royalties, dividends, distributions, and interest. If you'd like help with income investing, you can reach Capital Investment Advisors at yourwealth.com. That's yourwealth.com. Here's what's happening in the world that matters economically. And then it leads to a big PR misstep from a fast food company. And the big headline of this week, I would say economic headline, had to do with, you guessed it, inflation. It's not the typical CPI that we always hear about, consumer price index. We all know that that's inflation. We know that so many things are tied to CPI. For some reason, Connor, the Fed likes to look at PCE, which is a really fairly different way to look at inflation, personal consumption expenditures, which is another way to look at inflation. And the reality here is that those numbers were pretty good if you're looking for lower inflation. So for the week, or announced just this past week, for this past month, up about 0.4%. But only up 2.8% from a year ago. So we're in that magical 2% land, 2.8%. And then the headline PCE, which includes food and energy, which makes sense that you would include those things because you kind of need them, it was even less. So if you're including food and energy, headline PCE at 2.4%. Isn't that what the Fed wants?
That's all they've been saying for the last year and a half is we're trying to get back to 2%. Now, the question is going to be, are they hard-pressed on getting back to 2.0%, or is just somewhere in the neighborhood of 2 to 3%? Okay.
I think they're in that range. And I think that the 2% range is what the Fed does. They think about that. You've got this $27 trillion economy. Do they really think they can micromanage every single 0.1% or every 10 or 20 or any 10 basis points? I think they're close to home. They're close to where they want to go. That's, I think, good news for consumers because it could mean the Fed finally takes their foot off the brake pedal. Interest rates may start to come down at least a little bit. And that could be very helpful to the housing market, which, if you haven't bought a home, you're still priced out of the housing market. Housing prices are high. Mortgage rates are high. What's also interesting about housing, I can just see it happening because every time you get an imbalance or every time we have, and this is there's rule in economics, every time you get some sort of big mismatch between supply and demand, human nature doesn't stop. Human nature still gets married. And then people get married and have kids and they have a second child and a third child and all of a sudden they need more space. None of that slows down, but the housing market slowed down and people buying houses have slowed down, but human nature hasn't slowed down. So by nature, that demand for people moving up, moving to a bigger home, doing something different because their family, it's more appropriate for their family. All that does is fill up this giant reservoir drip by drip of demand. And that's how I see the housing market happening. I get asked a lot about, do we think the housing market's going to go down? Is it going to, if rates come down, are prices going to get, are we going to have a housing crash? With the demand that's been building up, it's hard to see home prices go down a whole lot.
Well, and even through this, you know, the amount of homes that have been sold has been lower, but home prices have started to creep back up again after kind of stalling out for
a few months. We got a Case-Shiller home price index number this past week as well. That was a little over 5%. So home prices on average in the United States are still 5% higher than where they were a year ago. And what the Fed has been trying to do with higher rates has largely worked. And the epicenter of where you see it working is the housing market. Higher rates, everyone slows down. Not only do they slow down from buying, they slow down from selling because they want to keep their old mortgage. So here we are, this reservoir of human nature demand, families growing, wanting to move, just keeps growing. That's not going to stop. So the minute we see, imagine we wake up tomorrow and all of a sudden mortgage rates are no longer flirting with 7%, but they're 5.5%. Still not even that much lower, but more affordable. Imagine the rush of people saying, wait a minute, now I can go buy. So if that happens and we still don't have a ton of demand on, we still don't have a ton of supply, just don't see how housing prices drop dramatically from here. Hopefully we get some more affordability for people with lower rates.
Yeah, and part of that just comes from seeing incomes continue to rise. And so we saw with this report, we also saw real incomes continue to rise from here. And so that's been a really positive sign in the economy, is we're starting to see wages continue to outpace inflation. And so whereas the last 2 years, the consumer was kind of just keeping up with prices, they may get a 4 or 5% raise, but prices are 4 to 5% higher. Now we're starting to see those raises, and prices aren't rising at the same pace, so their spending power is actually going up a little bit.
So you're saying even more of a tailwind to keep housing prices where they are or potentially move higher?
Yeah, and just the overall economy in general.
How about the Wendy's menu? Do you think that's ever going to come down?
Sounds like it's going to rely on demand, right? So
they really touched a nerve. So this week, Wendy's surge pricing. They're going to experiment with what they call dynamic pricing. But guess what? The nerve they touched on is inflation. Well, wait a minute. Dynamic pricing. I go to the drive-thru and it's super busy. Does that mean then I get surge pricing for my Wendy? What do they even call the Wendy's burger? Just the pad? I know they have Frosties.
The Baconator? Is that Wendy? I think that's Wendy's. Yeah.
The Baconator. So does that mean the Baconator is now $12 to buy a Baconator as opposed to $7 or $6. I don't know what the price is.
Now, in all fairness, what Wendy's would say is if you pull up at 11 o'clock in the morning and no one's in line, you may pay even less for your Baconator.
So, and this brings up the concept of dynamic and fluid pricing. We're used to it. If you think about it, most pricing has been that way for a long time. If an airline has a really popular destination, and those will be more expensive flights. Colorado in the winter for people to go skiing, and flying to the coast in the summer to hang out on the beach. Of course, you're going to get this supply-demand equilibrium prices that happens. But then we were introduced, I think, maybe in a more profound way when we started using Uber and Lyft. And you'd get used to a $12 Uber or Lyft ride, or it was $22. And then wait a minute, it's the holidays and everyone's going to a Christmas party because it's two Thursdays before Christmas. And now that $22 ride is $52. What? Where I'm going to go downtown and go to a game or a concert. And now all of a sudden what would have normally been a $20 ride, it's $40. We know that is surge pricing now in America. I think we've been indoctrinated to surge pricing. So the minute this article came out, they're touching on A, surge pricing, B, inflation. Is my Baconator going to inflate? And they tried to really walk it back. So they looked at this as a giant PR mistake. They actually, this is an email to CNN. Wendy's was very blunt and said, Wendy's will not implement surge pricing, which is the practice of raising prices when demand is highest. This was not a change in plans. It was never our plan to raise prices when consumers are visiting us the most. So I guess that just goes back to dynamic pricing. Or what is that? I'm not even sure I guess you just call it dynamic pricing, which is the way prices normally are. What's different here is a digital menu that can change quickly throughout the day.
Well, and I think what a lot of us are so accustomed to is when you pull up to the Wendy's drive-thru, you kind of know about what you're going to pay, right? And so now it just adds this element of decision in there of, well, do I actually want to pay $12 for my Baconator, or do I want to, now I need to go somewhere else where I normally would just stop at Wendy's on the way home.
Yeah, but they're saying that they're not going to raise prices, which is a practice where they're not going to do that, supposedly. So I don't even know what they're saying. Are they only going to lower prices when the line is slow?
I guess it's to be seen. I would think there's going to be some element of raising when demand is high and lowering when there's not as much demand.
I think this brings up a more interesting question, which is, do we start to just see dynamic or surge related pricing everywhere? Do we see it more blatantly everywhere? Could you go into the supermarket? Could you go to Kroger or Publix? And because it's Sunday afternoon and everyone's shopping, now milk instead of $4 is $4.50. And companies all across the landscape start pricing relative to their consumer traffic and their consumer demand. And do they do that in a way so that it discourages crowding and encourages lower periods during the week? Let's call it a Tuesday afternoon when at 2 o'clock, there's less people, let's say, at Publix versus a Sunday afternoon. Do they encourage more people to fill those shallow times or lower demand times with lower prices so they have a more balanced week? Does Starbucks do it? Now, I don't know if there's ever a non-busy time for Starbucks.
Yeah, they've already got the surge pricing on there.
It's surge pricing all the time. It's always busy. You know, I stopped going to Starbucks it's actually been a couple of years. Is Starbucks still always crowded every time you go?
Every time I drive by, there's a car line of at least 3 to 5 cars, it seems.
Have we gotten to a double-digit drink at Starbucks yet? Do we know?
Ooh, we'll have to check on that.
I'll tell you what, you start putting in surge pricing, you're going to see one of those caramel macchiatos, it's going to be double digits, which is scary to think about. More money matters, straight ahead. How about earnings? How far are we through for this quarter? And what do earnings look like? What's the health of the S&P 500 look like?
So we're about done. We're 97% of the way through, 98%. So we're pretty much all the way there. By most measures, it's been a pretty solid earnings season. Obviously, you've had the big headline with NVIDIA. Their profits were up 250% over the last year. That stole a lot of the news. You had Meta come out. They had a good quarter, announced the dividend. But it was really some of the usual suspects. Technology had a good quarter. Industrials, actually consumer staples. So talking about some of that dynamic pricing, being able to pass through some of those higher costs on.
Imagine surge pricing or dynamic pricing during the pandemic for toilet paper.
Oh boy.
It would have been $100 a roll.
Maybe that would have prevented everyone from stocking up on it.
Besides toilet paper and paper towels, what is the number one, when you just mentioned consumer staples, what comes to mind? What's one product that comes to mind that is the ultimate consumer staple good that you buy at the grocery store? Or I guess you can get off of Amazon now.
When I think consumer staple, I mean, I go to cereal, right?
Cereal.
Yeah, it's
cereal.
Like the ultimate consumer staple product.
All right, I think, this is what I think of, Pringles. I think of Pringles chips for some reason because A, they're Procter & Gamble. B, they're in a manufactured tube and they're pressed together. So there's almost something even manufactured about the food that they are. I guess it's food. We don't have a whole lot of Pringles in the house. But we do have Wendy's, and we will continue, I'm sure, we'll continue to have some Wendy's once in a while. Much more than Wendy's, though, of course, is Chick-fil-A. And still, to this day, let's go to Chick-fil-A. Nah, guys, it's Sunday. Let's go to Chick-fil-A. No, nah, it's Sunday. So it's still far and beyond the number one fast food choice in our family. The reality here is that America has, even though the economy's been strong, we've had an unemployment rate of 4% or less for almost 2 straight years. we have now inflation. Just this past week, the PCE, the
personal consumption expenditures,
different than CPI. I was hanging on CPI, is back in the 2% range. So we had 2.8% on the, if you strip out food and energy, or where were we on that? Under 3% for the headline number. And then if you take out food and energy, it's what, 2.8%.
So yeah, the core number that the Fed, that's their favorite barometer of inflation, came in at 2.8%.
And to some extent, it's interesting because CPI, Consumer Price Index, is easy to understand because it's this fixed basket of goods, and you can measure what it costs last month versus this month versus last year, and you can get a range. Whereas PCE, consumption expenditures, is really about how much we spend on these items. So to some extent, we're spending more because prices are inflated, but then it also takes into account the demand destruction that comes with, well, I'm not going to buy that ticket because it's just too expensive. The CPI is just a sticker price here. This is what it costs. The PCE is really about what we're spending and how we're being impacted by inflation. That's why the Fed likes PCE, I guess, so much more.
Yeah, because it's more consumer behavior driven and, okay, well, meat prices are higher, so I may downshift to chicken or pork or something else that would
still— Substitutions.
Exactly.
Dynamic meat pricing. Everything's going to be dynamic. Wendy started it. They messed up and they made it seem like they were going to do surge pricing. They walked that back. They said, we will not increase our prices when we have high demand. So I don't really even know then why. I don't get it. It's, if they're not going to increase the prices, does that mean they're only going to decrease? Who knows? But I could see one day in a digital supermarket when every price is in some way immediately dynamic. Connor, your point is that all prices are dynamic. It's always a supply-demand equilibrium. We find a price that makes sense. There's enough supply in the consumer. They meet in the middle. It's the chart that we learn in economics. It's where the two lines cross. That's the price. It's the equilibrium. But it will be interesting to see a digital price of milk change in front of your eyes because there's three people staring at the same gallon of milk. It's scary to think about, but I don't know why that doesn't happen. I think that I can absolutely see a future with the amount of data processing and artificial intelligence that everything starts to change on a dime.
So. Well, and maybe, I mean, I think technology has been the hindrance to this point, but like you brought up the AI buzzword, that actually could actually even help inflation in the long run if it's just more efficiently finding consumers to goods and charging the appropriate pricing.
Oh, you're saying something good about artificial intelligence.
It's
not going to take over the world? Take our jobs?
Hopefully not.
Take everything from us? We don't need you anymore, humans. We've got artificial intelligence. I did a podcast interview. Speaking of the human brain, how many iPhones worth of information do we store in our memory, Connor Miller? How many iPhones worth?
Not even one?
5,000. So we're not outmatched just yet. We have in our memory and our capacity, the human brain can store information equivalent to about 5,000 iPhones. Now, I don't know if I were to couch that, are they also talking about iPhone, iCloud in the clouds? I'm not so sure, but at least
either way,
still ahead.
5,000 is a lot.
I don't know
if my brain is quite that. Maybe it's like half that.
It is. The difference is our recall. We have this amazing capacity for storage, but when we get tired, we get stressed as we age and we don't keep our mental fitness up. I was talking about to a neuropsychologist about retirees and how to keep sharp and vibrant in a happy retirement is that we lose our recall comes back. We get less efficient. So we can't grab onto the information we want quite as well as we peak in our early 20s.
So we have less RAM, right? Is that the
I think it's a little bit like that.
Technical term for it?
Lots of memory, which continues to expand even as we get older. But I guess the processing RAM, I can grab the information, that can start to get a little compromised. That's not you yet. So you're never lost for a word. The number of 401k millionaires, Connor Miller, and this is great news, up over 11% in a brand new report from last year. And those 401k millionaires are what? They are the poster children for staying the course. Think about how long it takes to amass $1 million in 401k money. Average balance of the 401k in 2023 ended up, was up 14% to $118,600. This is from Fidelity. The average individual retirement account up 12%, so IRA versus a 401k, up to $116,000 or almost $117,000 in the fourth quarter of 2023. What struck me here, and I think that part of this is there was Yahoo did a similar story. I think this was CNBC, and I contributed to it with a reporter, and they wanted to know, well, if you get to $1 million, that sounds great. What's next? Can you take your foot off the gas pedal? Can you slow down? And of course, the answer, Connor Miller, is what? More money means more happiness. Of course, you keep, remember, there's a plateau effect. So yeah. Maybe can you slow down?
To a certain point, right? I mean, isn't that what the happiness effect is? You got to get to a certain point, but then it plateaus off.
So there is I believe that there is, and my research has shown, and there's other research that thinks of it slightly differently, but there is a very highly correlated increase in happiness / less worry in the early stages of saving money, meaning that a little bit more, an extra $10,000 in income can be a big jump in happiness. An extra $50,000 saved, big jump in happiness. But then when we get to a certain point, we get what I think of as diminishing marginal happiness per new dollar. So then once we get to a point, And the average happy retiree, and I've adjusted these numbers for the massive inflation we've just lived through, is about $1.25 million, so $1.25 million, and then happiness levels tend to level off. So new money above that doesn't necessarily bring new happiness levels, and the median numbers around $700,000 for the happy retiree median.
Does it ever go down? Like, is there a certain wealth threshold where it actually goes down, or does it just, you get that diminishing level of return?
You know, this is something I believe, I have not done that research on when at some point does it start to go down? I believe it's a Malcolm Gladwell book that talks about that. When you get to a point, so it's almost this upside down you, and yes, your happiness levels go up and up and up. But when you get to, I don't know the exact level this was, but it was extremely wealthy, those happiness levels actually go down. And I think I remember, and again, I'm getting older. My memory's supposed to not stop, but my recall is not maybe what it was when I was 25. But I remember, I want to say it was Malcolm Gladwell, could be another author, literally said, more money, more problems. And all of a sudden, happiness levels started to crater. What was interesting also about all the stories that were floating around from the Fidelity study that came out this week was all about 401k millionaires, was that those balances are still not back to where they were in 2001. That, I think, was the most interesting part about that story.
Yeah, so we were speculating, because when you think of the stock market, now it's back to all-time highs, but as of, I guess, December 31st, 2023.
It's only a little over 2 months ago.
Should have been about back to all-time highs. Not all 401ks obviously are in stocks. Bonds are maybe not quite back to their highs, so that's a piece of it. Some people had to pull money out due to hardship. So that's, you know, all that factoring in to we're getting close, but not quite back to where we were.
And maybe part of there, here's another part of this, Connor. It's that more retirement savers are borrowing from their 401k plan. So this is also part of that story, ticked up to almost 9%. So the percentage of workers who took a loan from their 401k, including for hardship reasons, up to almost 9%. So, and that's up from in the 7% range in 2022. So again, remember, federal law allows workers to borrow up to 50% of their retirement account, up to $50,000. So think of it as if you have, whenever you get to $50,000, that's the limit. So, and then you can pay that back over the course of X number of years, depending on what your 401k plan says. Interesting that we've seen those numbers climb. Could be part of the reason that balances at least from the Fidelity study, are still not back to where they were 2 years ago. Now, this year so far, it's a young year, but we're now in, let's call, I think of, when I was growing up in Pennsylvania, I didn't really think of March as spring, but now living in Atlanta, I do. Because it flowers are going to be coming out. They're already starting to come out a little bit.
It's almost like a false spring because you think it should start getting
warmer.
And
then we get hit again. But this year, we've seen the Capital One and Discover merger. We've seen two big technology companies initiate dividends for the first time. So we have Meta, formerly known as Facebook, and Salesforce that is also initiated a dividend for the first time, 40 cents a share quarterly dividend. We also saw stocks finally peak back above their all-time high that took over 2 years to get to. So if you felt frustrated over the last couple of years, it's because the markets have actually been pretty frustrating, but been good for the better part of for 12, 13, 14 months, because we went, 2002 was down, 2003 was up, but it really was just recovering from 2002. And here we are in early 2024, finally just started to make some new headway. Bitcoin back to hitting $60,000 per Bitcoin this week. And then a resilient consumer, GDP for at least the last quarter of last year, 3%. And even the Nikkei, the Japanese stock market, finally made it back to an all-time high after what,
34 years.
34 years.
Mind-blowing.
This week, there was an awful lot of conjecture around what Warren Buffett's really thinking. What is he saying and what is he writing between the lines? He gave a wonderful tribute to his longtime partner and friend, Charlie Munger, in his latest letter to shareholders, his annual letter. He talked about his sister, Birdie, and he says, again, this is just, the guy's so lovable. Not only is a genius investor over time, but also lovable because he always thinks, what is this a stock? Or before he buys a company, what would my sister, Birdie, it was Birdie, correct?
Yeah.
What would she own? Would this be an okay company for her to own for the long term? Just this, what kind of investment letters are going to make you cry, right? Only Warren Buffett can do that. But at the same time, he has this, and it's not the first time. In fact, it's often that I hear this from a shareholder letter from him, is that he keeps amassing cash. And the bigger he gets, even though the percentage is still not enormous, it's not small, it's about 18% in cash, is this shocking number. And people look at the number and they say, wait a minute, Berkshire has $167 billion in cash. And he's also saying it's going to be hard to find things of great value. Well, if you read between all those lines, is he saying the market's overvalued and he's in all this cash? Do I need to go to cash too, Connor Miller? And what the answer, of course, we know is what?
Of course, no.
Not to put you on the spot.
that was a little bit of an easy one. But no, I mean, using Buffett's philosophy, like he said, he's ever since, 1942, he's never had less than a majority of his assets in stocks because he knows, from experience, and he's got a lot of it, that over the long run, stocks are going to do well. It's the army of American productivity is going to continue to propel the economy and stocks higher over time. Of course, there's going to be periods of volatility, but he knows from experience that the long game is really the game you want to be playing.
Here we are. He was born in August of 1930. So in March of 1942, I guess he would have been 12 years old or 11 or 12 years old. And I don't know what grade would that be? That would be fifth or sixth grade. He was in fifth or sixth grade. And I should know, I have kids that same age. And this was a quote from his most recent letter. I can't remember a period since March 11th, 1942, the date of my first stock purchase, that I've not had the majority of my net worth in equities, U.S.-based equities. And so far, so good. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell below 100 on that fateful day back in 1942 when Buffett pulled the trigger, quote, pulled the trigger on his first stock. He was down about $5. That's more than lunch in 1942. He was down $5 by the time school was out. Soon things turned around, and now that index hovers around 38,000. America has been a terrific country for investors. Now, some thoughts around his rates of return. Now, even he says, and this starts to make a lot of sense, you've got a company, Berkshire, as a entity. If you do the market cap, shares times the price, and you're looking at $850 billion to $900 billion, almost a $1 trillion market cap. So $167 million in cash is a lot of cash, but it's only about 18%. So technically, just like when he was a kid, he's still mostly invested. That means 82% of Berkshire Hathaway is still invested in companies. Now, a few of those are private, but the big chunk, the vast majority of Berkshire, those are publicly traded companies. Now, what he's also saying is because they've gotten so big, it's hard for them to really move the meter beyond normal market returns. When he was young and spry, he was able to have some huge returns. Now, you go back to 1974, Berkshire was down 48, almost 50% in 1 year. But we had some, they had some really big years, up 102% in the late 1970s, up 93% in the mid 1980s. So they had a couple really big years in the early going. And then more recently, the returns have been a little bit more market oriented. But even the last 25 years, he's still ahead. So, and this is what's interesting in the power of compounding. Just a little bit of math over a longer period of time can really add up. From if you go back over the last 25 years, the market, and Connor, you did this math here. We looked at what, 1995 or 1990?
We did the last 30 years. So going back to February of 94, March of 94, back to 1999, and then also 2004.
So if from 1999 till today, the S&P was what? Approximately, on average per year?
I believe it was 10%. Let's double check on that.
Let's pull out these numbers. We've got 7.5% per year equated to 553%.
Yeah, so back to 1994, S&P 500.
That was 1994, okay.
10% per year, so that's about 1,800% in total over the last 30 years.
And then the S&P 500.
That was the S&P 500. Berkshire then is up 13% per year over the same time frame.
Oh, right. Okay, that's right. And so here, and this is the point I'm trying to make. So over the last 30 years, the S&P 500 is a little over 10%. Berkshire is is about 13. Close. Clearly, Berkshire did better. But if you now take that compounded full rate of return, S&P 500 about 1,800%, 1,800%, still a wonderful return. But those extra couple percentage points per year over a long period of time, Berkshire up 3,800%. Little bit over a long period of time creates an entire country like Iceland. Now, let's look at these numbers I actually cannot even comprehend. And we've double-checked these just to make sure. They almost don't even make sense, but we'll talk about it anyway. So you've got this, my favorite page every year to look is Berkshire Hathaway's performance for the S&P 500. And again, remember, we're not recommending going out and buying or selling the stock. This is just in the annual letter. We're reading its page. It's one of the early pages, kind of midway through the report. But if you take a look at the end, they have averaged, Berkshire has averaged 19.8%, the S&P 500, 10.2. But this table goes all the way back to 1965. That compounded rate of return gets us to a little over 31,000% for the S&P 500. Put it in money terms, $10,000 turned into $3.1 million, $10,000 into $3.1 million. Or a little over 300x your money. Now, we take a close to 20% return over that same period of time. $10,000 turns into $438 million. It's just hard to fathom that. And so much of it is because of the latter several years compounding for a long period of time. So that's not just 300x your money. it's 44,000 times your money. That's the number.
So you would think in your brain, well, double the annual return, double the money, right? I end up with 6 million. No, you end up with 438 million.
The power of compounding, a little bit of a change for a really long period of time can be absolutely tremendous. And this is from somebody who got started early. Morgan Housel will say, well, he had a head start on a lot of people that are in the business today. He had $1 million right around age 30. So we go back to, well, let's see, when was he? He was born in 1930. So by 1960, he had $1 million. Berkshire Performance, we can see it was way back to 1965. Again, not talking about buying or selling any of these companies that we mentioned here today. Simply, I think, really, really important educational examples around some of the most important concepts when it comes to being a happy retiree, an early retiree. Morgan Housel would call it just the sheer vast power of surviving and allowing yourself to catch the tailwind of compounding. We've been talking most of the year about last year and a half about inflation, 2 years about inflation, and the numbers are getting better. PCE, personal consumption expenditures, down to the 2% range, which is welcome news. The market liked it this week to some extent. However, there was great expectation that we'd see all these interest rate cuts this year, and that there's been some cool water on those expectations. So yes, the market is still saying we might get some later in the year, but not nearly as many as that we headed into the year. So we're just effectively in a pause. We're in a Fed rate pause. They raised rates. We know that happened, 11, 12 times? And then they're staying put. So the question is, what happens historically between the raise and the first time they start to lower?
Really, the answer is it depends. It depends on how long they're able to pause. If there's volatility in the economy or the markets that are forcing their hand to cut and be more accommodative, that can be a bad thing for stocks. But generally speaking, the longer that they pause, actually the better it is for the markets. And really, in my opinion, the answer behind that is the longer they can wait, that means the economy is good. If they're not having to cut like they did in 2020 or in 2008 really quickly, that could be signs of stress. If they're able to just sit back like they are today, we've got low unemployment, we've got rising wages, inflation's coming down. Those are all good things for both the economy and historically for the stock market.
You're right. So that makes a lot of sense as I look at this data here. If you look 2018 through 2019, we had 225 days of the Fed technically pausing, and market was up 19% during that period of time. If you go back to February of 89 through June of 89, it was over a little over 100 days that the Fed had paused. At rate of return, they are a little over 13%. That actually, I think that's really good context. The Fed is not lowering rates today because the economy is pretty good. They don't need to. So the longer the Fed would pause and not start to reduce rates, makes sense that you'd be potentially a stock market tailwind. We'll leave on that optimistic note, or we'll wrap up today on that optimistic note. Connor Miller, thanks for being here, my friend, as always. You can find me and Connor Miller and the Money Matters team, easy to do so, at yourwealth.com. That's yourwealth.com. Have a wonderful rest of your day.
This is provided as a resource for informational purposes and is not to be viewed as investment advice or recommendations. This information is being presented without consideration of the investment objectives, risk tolerance, or financial circumstances of any specific investor and might not be suitable for all investors. The mention of any company is provided to you for informational purposes and as an example only and is not to be considered investment advice or recommendation or an endorsement of any particular company. Past performance is not indicative of future results. Investing involves risk, including possible loss of principal. There is no guarantee offered that investment return, yield, or performance will be achieved. The information provided is strictly an opinion and for informational purposes only, and it is not known whether the strategies will be successful. There are many aspects and criteria that must be examined and considered before investing. This information is not intended to and should not form a primary basis for any investment decision that you may make. Always consult your own legal, tax, or investment advisor before making any investment, tax, estate, or financial planning considerations or decisions. Investment decisions should not be made solely based on information contained herein.